listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Good evening and welcome to Aloud at Central Library. Pleasure to meet you here tonight. Welcome you here. I'm Louise Steinman, the program director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which makes all of these free Aloud programs possible. After all they had witnessed, whole realms of the peculiar had been held in reserve. I just think that's such a great sentence. You could just walk around Los Angeles and say that. After all they had witnessed, whole realms of the peculiar had been held in reserve. Whitehead sets Zone 1 a year or so after a zombie apocalypse. The disease apparently came from nowhere and struck the entire world, spreading from the zombified to their victims via a traditional munch, chomp. He writes, "Just another day at the office when she got bit by some New York wacko while loading up on spring mix at the corner deli's salad lounge." That's how it went down. The protagonist says of his old sixth grade teacher, Miss Alcott, who smelled of jasmine when she passed his desk plucking vocabulary quizzes. Who knows what Colson Whitehead will come up with next, but it sure is great reading this witty and ruminative nightmare about the living dead by the brilliant novelist who brought us The Intuitionist, John Henry Days, and Sag Harbor. In his decade and a half as a novelist, Colson Whitehead has written about boys coming of age in Long Island, a grown man in an identity crisis, and a female elevator inspector living in an alternate version of New York City. Colson himself grew up in Manhattan, and after graduating from Harvard, he started working at the Village Voice, where he wrote television, book, and music reviews. He's the recipient of many, many awards, including a MacArthur Fellowship, a Whiting Writers Award, and a fellowship at the Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers at the New York Public Library. His highly acclaimed novels include The Intuitionist, John Henry Days, Apex Hides the Hurt, and Sag Harbor. And he's also the author of Colossus of New York, a book of essays about the city. In conversation with Colson tonight is David Kippen, who you can find most of these days at the Hammer Museum, where his wonderful bookstore, Libro Schmibros, has been in residence, or you can go over to Boyle Heights and check it out. His co-director, Colleen Jaretsky, is here somewhere in the audience, so you should, there she is back there. It's a wonderful place to visit and check out a book. Until January 2010, David was the literature director of the National Endowment for the Arts. He was a book critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, and his introductions to the WPA Guides to Los Angeles and San Francisco were recently published, and we have one of them out there in the lobby. Please welcome Colson Whitehead and David Kippen. Colson will start with a reading. Thank you so much.
Howdy-do. Thanks so much for coming out. The book is called Zone 1, and here the main character, Mark Spitz, not his real name, is thinking about what he does at night. Initially, the dreams, when safe nights permitted them, favored a classic anxiety paradigm. He was enmeshed in the institutional structures of his previous existence, in school, one of his blank jobs, and the other students and the teachers, fellow employees and bosses, were dead. Dead in a precipitous state of decay, winnowed by the plague. Bones gliding under taut skin at every movement, blackened gums bared when they told a joke or introduced a complicating element to the setup. The exam is today, the supervisor's on the warpath. Their wounds mushy and livid. They leaked constantly from sores, eyes, ears, bites. In the dreams, he was not bothered by their appearance, nor were they. They informed him that they'd all studied for the test, save him. The big assignment was due after lunch, and not next week. The performance review was already underway, abetted by secret cameras. Not that he'd ever had a performance review in his life. It was an erotic curveball his subconscious came up with to freak him out, employing the exotic slang of bona fide grown-ups. They were not the rabid dead, or stragglers. They acted pretty much the same as they had before, his best friend, his science teacher, his distracted boss. Except for the plague thing, These were the dreams he'd been having for years. The dreams changed once he made it to his first big settlement, once he gets out of the wasteland. He was no longer late for the final exam of a class he didn't know he'd enrolled in, or about to deliver the big presentation when he suddenly realized he left the only copy in the back seat of the taxi. These dreams unfurled in a theater of the mundane. There was no pulse-quickening escalation of events, no stakes to mention. He took the train to work. He jawed with his girlfriend, and all the supporting characters were dead. The dead said, "Let's stay in and get a movie, honey. You want fries with that? Do you know what time it is?" While flies skittered on their faces, searching for a soft flap to bury eggs in, and their arms terminated at the elbow to showcase a white peach of bone, fringed with dangling muscle and dripping tendons. He told them, "Sure, let's stay in and snuggle. I'll take the side salad, thank you. And it's 10 of 5. Gets dark early this time of year." He downward dogged in a drop-in yoga class as the scale next to him broke in half while trying the pose. No one remarked upon this sight. Not him, not the dead teacher, not the enthusiastic and limber dead around him, and not the bisected scale on the floral-patterned hemp mat, who flopped grotesquely through the rest of the hour like a real trooper. He got into his street clothes in the locker room as the yuppie skull beside him dragged an expensive watch over his wrist, grating the fresh scabs there. On impulse, did someone say, That's nothing. On impulse, he purchased a deluxe combo juice at the cafe on the way out and decided not to say anything when the pimply skull dropped a banana slice into the blender. He hated banana. He drank it anyway, blowing into the striped straw to dislodge a plug of pulp, and stepped out into the sidewalk into the rush hour stream of the dead on their way home, the paralegals, resigned temps, bike messengers, and slump-shouldered massage therapists, the panoply of citizens in the throes of their slow decay. He took the subway to the commuter rail, curling his fingers around the pole, still warm from the scale who'd grasped it moments before. In the advertisements, lods just above eye level, airbrushed heads of the dead hawked trade schools and remedies. Some of the dead entered the train politely, and others were quite rude as they shouldered into the car when he tried to gain the platform. Everybody trying to eke it home. On the commuter platform, he made sure his monthly pass was secured in the nook in his wallet, and he pictured the night ahead. Order in from his go-to takeout spot, pop open one of the beers, and watch the reality show he DVR'd 3 days before. He woke up as the train left the tunnel and they were out of the underground. The only unsettling thing about the dream was that he'd never taken a yoga class in his life. This series eluded the category of nightmare. He woke refreshed, or at least aloft in a routine state of morning dread in equilibrium for months. This new vintage of dreamscape left him feeling curiously indifferent. The dead small-talked, recited speculation over tomorrow's cold front, numbly caromed from task to task as they had before, but they were sick. He recalled the theory of dreams from the old days that declared them wish fulfillment, and another declaring that you are every person in your dreams, and each theory seemed equally plausible and moot, and in the end he didn't spend too much time analyzing. He was a busy man these days.
So what isn't this book about?
I guess I was going to say real estate, but it's actually some real estate in there. Because downtown Manhattan, even in the apocalypse, will be prized territory.
And the uptowners, as in the book, will be converging on downtown.
Yes. Gentrification continues even when everybody's dead. It's sort of inexorable.
I mean, can a book be an allegory about everything?
I think I was just trying to describe my everyday existence.
Okay.
The main character, Mark Spitz, is on the run from zombies. But for me, the story is just about a guy trying to make it through the day without getting killed. And he has a job he doesn't particularly like that much. He'd like to move to a better neighborhood. He's pretty fond of organic arugula. And even though the world is dead, those desires and sort of routines continue. So is he already half dead, even before the apocalypse? What's left after the world has been devastated? It's a good question.
Now, you're a New York kid, I'll cop to this. I generally, you know, as an Angeleno, as an L.A. kid, don't love New York books, and yet I adore this book, and I was asking myself why, and I think it's because you grew up there. You love the place, and it's in your bones, the way L.A. is in some of our bones. What does New York mean to you?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's a ghost I'm chasing. It's the only place I feel completely comfortable. I spent a year and a half in San Francisco and, you know, came running back. The mission was to see if I could live somewhere else, and the answer was no. So this is my first book, you know, set in New York. The Intuitionist is a kind of alternative Gotham, gather up out of detective novels and detective movies. So I was overdue. And then it seemed, just from growing up in, you know, New York in the 70s, it was a post-apocalyptic New York. You walk past mounds of rubble. You'd see movies like The Warriors and assume it's a documentary about current events. And I think, you know, whether you're from LA or somewhere else, you've been someplace a long time, you're always superimposing that your old idea of the city over the city that's there now. So the Starbucks comes, but you can still see the place where you used to have, you know, play Asteroids and the pizza joint. And as you walk around any place you love, that ghost city is always encroaching upon what's here now. So Mark Spitz is enacting that sort of idea of the changing city. I mean, it's altered by his damaged psychology. But he loves this place. And even though everything's been destroyed, he wants to still live that dream of being a hip downtown New Yorker, even if there's all the clubs are gone, and anyone who would be in a club would be trying to eat him.
Now, you used to be a professional culture critic for The Voice, and still dabble in that even nowadays. Now, on your old beat, presumably, you would be writing the piece right now about how Zone One and Contagion and maybe the Planet of the Apes remake.
Well, you need three for a trend piece.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
So I mean, as the perspective, you know, as prospectively on the receiving end of one of those pieces, do they seem any more of a crock now than they did before, or do you think you are to some degree not just working through your own stuff but speaking for the zeitgeist?
Well, I mean, I have sympathy for people who have to do them. I did them all the time. You know, I remember I became a TV columnist, and the big shows that year were ER and Chicago Hope, and it's like ER, a show that's, you know, 10 years in development, Chicago Hope 2 years. What kind of moronic connection can I make to the fact that they're debuting at the same time? So, you know, zombies are big. You know, I feel disconnected from the young folk who have zombie marches and dress up and, you know, have zombie makeout parties. I'll just make that up. Maybe they have those. I don't know. I'm terrible, definitely now, with trends in my own work. You know, perhaps with the Intuitionist, the elevator inspector wave I was trying to catch, but they're still waiting for.
You did it so well, everybody who had an elevator, okay. Yeah, they threw it out. They knew they couldn't top you.
I assume Buffy was done with, you know, the vampires are done with Buffy. That was wrong. And I assumed, like, when Pride and Prejudice and Zombies came out, you know, you couldn't get more zombified as a culture. So I had to say, I'm committed to this, you know, paying homage to my childhood influences, and I'm going to write this book. What does it matter? I mean, do I care that 3 years from now zombies will be over? I mean, they weren't, but that's what I sort of assumed. And you have to write the book that you have to do at that moment. You're compelled to do it. You don't have a choice anyway. So what's the larger cultural current going on? I don't know. You know, larger cultural currents can't write my books. So if they could, I guess I'd pay more attention. I'm just stuck, you know, doing what I have to do, and I can't step outside of it and get the larger picture.
Well, you do it so damn well, and I don't just mean that to flatter you. I mean, you and I did not grow up reading literary fiction. Not many people do. We grew up, you know, going to cheesy movies and reading thrillers, and you do that stuff so well. I mean, you write action so well. The first set piece in the book takes place in a human resources office of an otherwise deserted office building, and Mark Spitz wanders in, and all the zombies are there, still in their, you know, office wear, although it's hanging a little loosely off their you know, emaciated frames. And there's a moment in there where you use the phrase, time slowed down. And you hear this in accounts of people in extremity. But I mean, how did you go about joining the ranks of action writers and trying to do a scene that, whatever its literary merits, also was really frickin' exciting?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, because I'm tackling, you know, different subjects with each book, I have to relearn, you know, what I like from this form, what I don't, what conventions I want to keep. So, you know, my previous book, Sag Harbor, was very different and had different rhythms. It's not very action-oriented. The only, you know, big thing that happens is the main character gets his braces off, like in Chapter 7. So that's the only action sequence in that one. So I want to salute the George Romero trilogy. I want to expand the idea of a certain kind of horror novel, and then also do it in my own voice. And so, yes, I know we want narrative discharge in the action scene, and going and slowing
it
down.
Narrative discharge. That's
yeah. We want, you know, things to happen. We want the excitement. We want to know what happens in the conclusion of the sequence. I have to slow it down. You know, in the gore-drenched sections, I have to keep Mark Spitz, the main character, in there, and he's always processing what's going on. So even though I am trying to obey certain beats in a horror novel, a zombie story, I have to do it my own way, and sometimes that means in between the first bite and the second bite, Mark Spitz is going to think about his childhood and how he got to this horrible place.
Which actually doesn't work against the suspense. In fact, while you're reading about his childhood and really interested in it, you're also in the back of your mind, as you should be, thinking, but how's he going to get out of the
human race? Hopefully.
It's very
yeah.
suspenseful. Yeah. Did George Romero invent zombie fiction? Do you have a feeling for where the tradition comes out of him?
I mean, he said he's indebted to I Am Legend, the novel. My conception of the zombie, I think, starts with I Am Legend.
Written by Richard Matheson, still alive in West Hills right now, about 30 miles from us.
Richard, are you here? yeah, I mean, there are three adaptations of that, the Will Smith, Omega Man, Last Man on Earth. I'm partial to Omega Man because it's 70s and everyone has an afro and stuff like that. But and so he tries to have a scientific viral explanation for vampirism, and that's sort of taken for granted now. If you get bit by a werewolf, it's something in the blood, it's a virus. And then I would go from there to, and also Empty City, Man Alone.
Yeah.
You know, that's the backdrop. And then I would go to Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Mm-hmm. To me, the pod people are zombies. I think my interpretation of the zombie terror is your spouse, your kid, your mom, your dad, your family, your friends, proving what you've always known about them, which is that they're monsters. And so the switch gets flipped, the role is changed, and everybody who is pretending to be civilized and not a creature is no longer pretending, and they want to eat you. So that's Invasion of the Body Snatchers. You know, they talk, they look the same, but they do want to kill you and get rid of you. And I remember seeing the 78 version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers and be completely terrified by just that notion that you never know who's going to turn, like Donald Sutherland at the end, you're going to reach out for comfort and he's going to go, ah. And then there's the Romero trilogy,
yeah.
Which furnishes us with the slow-moving zombies. I like 28 Days Later. It's really scary, but, you know, I'm just a different generation.
Now, there's two kinds of zombies in Zone 1. There are the Skells, who are, you know, are after you and want to eat you. And then there are the stragglers, a much smaller, and actually you put a number on it, 1%, which, you know, is you know, a numeral we hear a lot about nowadays,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, yeah.
And they are just sort of skulking around, haunting their former haunts. And you know, the sweepers, the members of the team that Mark Spitz is on, make mock of them in ways that sometimes feel a little Abu Ghraib-ish to me. They come up with, it's almost like they're captioning cartoons. You know, the fellow hanging out by the copy machine is saying, you know, more toner stat, and such thing. And I wondered if you were a straggler.
Well, I think, you know, if you go back to that early idea of the city that I was talking about, that's very nostalgic and very sentimentalized. Mm-hmm. The stragglers are monuments to who they used to be.
Yeah.
That's how I see them. They're ghosts. And the survivors, in a different sort of way, are also carrying, you know, their former dead selves, the remnants of the dead world, into this new place. So they're both these highly sentimentalized, traumatized folks who are neurotically attached to their pasts. So, I mean, that's part of my idea of the city in Colossus, and Mark Spitz becomes a way of expanding upon it. But who would what would you bring back? What's the first thing you would bring back in after the apocalypse, once everything's settled? What would you look for? What's the first thing you would look for in your house to make sure it's still there? Apart from Aunt Ethel, who you left because she was decomposing, and there are the zombie stragglers, but the survivors are human stragglers, and I think we'd all have some sort of straggler aspect after the apocalypse, and I think we all have, you know, straggler parts of us now.
So if you were a straggler, where would we find you?
On my couch in front of waiting for the DVR to warm up. I take a lot of naps there, you know, in between work and on my couch, so my body's hardwired.
Well, speaking of other only arguably productive activities, you just did a longish piece for Harper's about your adventures competing in the World Series of Poker.
Yeah, it wasn't Harper's, it was Grantland.
Sorry about that.
No, problem. A new, newish, last 5 months. Sports and Pop Culture magazine put out by ESPN. And, if I seem a little bit deflated today, because it was one of the peak experiences of my life, I know I'll never repeat it.
If you're good now, why not become a pro?
Well, I mean, you can't, you know, the whole thing, you know, was a journey.
Did you make any dough?
I made no money.
Oh, okay.
But I learned a lot in here. You know, they called me up and said, you know, do you want to write about anything about sports? And I was like, no, I hate sports. And then they said, well, your agent said you play poker. Do you want to go and cover the World Series of Poker, this, you know, 6-week-long tournament in Las Vegas? And I was like, no, I don't want to go to Vegas. And they're like, well, what, you know, instead of paying you, we paid your entrance fee, and you played in the World Series of Poker. And I was like, yes, that's a chance of a lifetime. But then I realized I'm just a home player, and I don't know how to play tournament poker. So it was like 2 months of, I got a poker coach, a woman named Helen Ellis, who is also a writer and moonlights as a poker player, or vice versa. I got a physical trainer to help me with the rigors of sitting in a chair for 10 hours, picking up chips and stuff and putting them. And then I went to...
You've been picking up chips on the couch, presumably, for quite some time. But
yeah. Well, this is like, you know, different than lateral. And then I would, you know, I would take my kid to school at 9 a.m. and get on the bus to Atlantic City and gamble, and then come back at like 2 a.m., sleep, pick her up from school. and that was my sort of life for a few weeks. And then I went to the World Series of Poker and, you know, the piece... I'm not sure if you've ever done this, but because I wasn't getting paid, it was like long. If I had been paid, it would have been 10 pages, but because what I was doing for free, it was 60 pages. And it was coming out in installments, and so I would get feedback from like the web and Twitter, and so I haven't done something like that before. Usually you write a novel and you're just cooped up for 2 years and I'm depressed. And this was really exhilarating, and I don't know how to recreate it. I can hire actors to like pretend to you know. That was it.
Does it make you wonder what it would be like to write a novel with that kind of open source feedback all the time?
Well, I mean, because I'm always revising. You know, yeah. I'll write through pages and go back and rewrite the first page, then add another 5 pages and revise 6, 7, and 4. So my idea of like novel writing is that it's not done until everything's there, and you can go back and even things out and get the narrative voice in equilibrium. So, but something about this where here's a self-contained installment, move on to the next one, you can't go back, was different. But I couldn't write fiction without knowing that I could go back and change the first sentence.
Did it help? Well, let's see. Did you change the first sentence, or did you always know what it was going to be? I know it's about his love of New York. He always wanted to live in New York. Did you start with that?
That was there pretty early.
Yeah.
The last line too. You know, I came up with the first day when I started thinking of it, and I'm the kind of writer who has to know the ending and the beginning. I outline. This was like 4 months of outlining. Usually, it's 6 months or a year, and the outline can change as. You write the book. It's not fixed in stone. But I have to know what the destination is. Yeah. It seems like it's hard enough to find the right words each day. If you don't even know what's going to happen, like is the sheriff going to arrest the main character that day? I mean, if you don't even know what you have to do that day, it seems like crazy hard. So when I wake up, I know that I'm going to just describe the police station, or they get in the car and talk about death. That helps, helps me. So.
There's the old Henry James line about, maybe it's not even Henry, something about, part of writing being a very good noticer, and you always seem to have that down. Your descriptions of people and environments seem incredibly precise. Did that help in poker as you were studying other players' faces?
I had to... my regular game is a home game where we're just hanging out together at the house, and the stakes are very low. But I had to learn to watch people. You don't look at your cards like everyone else looks at their cards. Like, you don't just get dealt and then you look at them. Like, you wait and look at everybody, and see if they're happy with them or not. And so I had to, it was really sort of poker boot camp, and I had to learn to really play as opposed to if you're up, give me some beer and chips, and then we'll pick up a hand after that.
Now, I have to say, I don't mean to fixate on the poker, because actually it bores me to tears, as any game that doesn't involve words does. But where's the appeal? Why not word games?
But before we talk about how I hate word games, for me, these weird little tiles, I put words together. I don't put tiles together, to get a double word score. So for me, it's a totally different head than what I normally do when I sit down. And people assume that, if you're... I walk around and someone's like, oh, you have a pen? And I'm like, no. It's like, you're a writer. You should have a pen. And it's like, well, if you're a plumber, do you have to walk around with a plunger in your back pocket all day? you're putting sentences together and then triple word score is different, thing for me.
What do you have against Connecticut?
I have nothing against Connecticut. In the book, they're always talking about Connecticut is always modified by wretched, accursed Connecticut, mephitic Connecticut. And I had to pick some states. New Jersey's too obvious. but there has to be some state where the survivors hate going into, they wandering for 2 miles, and it's like, wait, where are we? And not Connecticut again. That's where I lost my arm last time. So Connecticut is the worst place of all the apocalypse. So that's, you know, sort of a recurring thing. But I thought it's totally random. Could have been Pennsylvania.
More specifically, there are places where the action sequences take place or the flashbacks take place where, you know, seemingly placid spots that are invaded by terror. I'm thinking of the human resources office, but also a casino, a fortune teller's storefront, a toy shop, a PTA meeting. How did you go about picking what forms of normality to violate?
Yeah, I mean, I do remember, like, I was in the summer, and I had to introduce Mim, who's sort of like a supporting character, but plays an important part. And I was like, what's going to happen to Mim? Like, what is her last night story? Last night is like the last sane night in the world. And when you get together in your walk-in freezer of the Greek restaurant where you're surrounded by zombies and you're hiding out, you, depending on how close you feel to the person you're in there with, you trade your last night story, and it's detailed or it's abbreviated. So I was like, what could happen to Mim and her last night? And it just came to me, this is the benefit of being a parent, zombie attack at the drop-off party. This seemed like the worst thing that could have happened to Mim. So the things like that where, you know, in some ways, there's so many different zombie attacks that have been done, and, you know, I haven't even seen most of the movies, so I don't even know, like, where I'm overlapping. But where can you put your own, you know, quirky stamp on things? So, like, the straggler is, like, my little variation on a zombie. Having this really perky soccer mom who's a survivor in the sort of foxhole with the main character seemed to appeal to me. I think a lot of supporting characters I feel a lot of affection for. I mean, Caitlin, the cheerleader, student council secretary, I would hate in real life, but, you know, by the time, you know, we got to the last chapter, you know, I definitely felt bad doing whatever happened to her. And Gary, too. So this book is sort of different in that I think differently about, you know, the people the protagonists are hanging out with these days. And, you know, I think that's in there, in Mim. And so you feel for her when she tells a story about the, you know, zombie attack at the drop-off party. It is, you know, one of the most atrocious things you can think to happen to this particular person.
You haven't really had much opportunity before to kill off characters, have you?
No, I mean, it was really fun. I think, you know, Sag Harbor and Zone 1 are, I think, kindred texts in a certain kind of way, because Sag Harbor addresses one part of my personality, a teenager going through life, optimistic. Even if he has setbacks, he always believes that if you just persevere, things will work out. And that's one part of my personality. And then another part of me hates everybody, wishes everybody was dead, so I could just walk around and be alone. And that's what Zone 1 addresses. Mm-hmm. So it was indeed fun to kill 95% of the population and then find different artful ways to describe it.
Now, you mentioned Mim. Mim's full name is Miriam Cohen Levy.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see a whole lot of Jewish characters in zombie stories, do you?
No, well, there are very few last names that we ever know, but it seemed like it was time for her to step up and take her place in zombie fiction.
Black people you actually do get to see in the Ur text, in Night of the Living Dead.
No, definitely what made me so neurotically attached to the zombie story is seeing Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. There were a lot of Black characters in Black exploitation movies, which I saw, you know, they're floating around on cable, late 70s. But seeing Night of the Living Dead on Halloween, you know, I think in sixth grade, and having just a normal Joe Blow black guy against the hordes of rampaging white people who wanted to eat him seemed like part of being Black in America. And that sort of stayed with me. And then seeing Dawn of the Dead like 2 years later, you know, I had very permissive parents. And so as a family outing.
How old are we talking about?
I was in junior high, so I was like 12, and it was rated X. You know, no one under 17 admitted because of gore. But, you know, instead of talking to each other, we always had a TV on. And so I saw A Clockwork Orange when I was like 10 with my parents. And I was like, Mommy, what's happening to that lady? And she's like, it's a comment on society. I'm watching the movie. So saw this incredibly gory movie, Dawn of the Dead, which also had, you know, a strong black male lead. And that's when I started having zombie anxiety dreams, like the part I read. Mm-hmm. So for the last 30 years, depending on what's going on in my life, the zombies are coming after me, and they're fast, they're slow. I have a machete or a machine gun, or I'm choking them like that. And actually, it's weird that now the book is out. You know, at least one person comes to me during the reading and is like, you know, I have zombie dreams too. So you're not alone, perhaps in this very room. So 30 years I've been having these things, and then July of 2009, July 4th, 2009, I had house guests in Long Island, and a good weekend, but it's a house that's really old, and you can sort of hear everything in the walls. It's like a no-sex house. I have to make that clear when I invite people over. You know, we'd love to have you out. The spare room is empty. It's a no-sex house. Can you bring some corn? Because you can hear everything. So I woke up, and I heard everyone laughing and making breakfast. And my father had, you know, passed away 2 months before. And also, on top of that, I sort of realized that I was getting divorced. And it was the wrong time to have people over. So I was like, can't you guys just go? I didn't say that, but I thought that. Instead of saying that, I just went back to sleep. I forced myself to have another round of sleep. And I had this dream that I was in New York in an apartment, and I wanted to go into the living room, but I wasn't sure if the zombies had been swept out yet. And then I woke up and I was like, that seems like, you know, a logistical nightmare. How do you get the zombies out when the war is over? They hang around like house guests who won't leave. And then usually when you have like a dream about, you know, a dream and it's like, oh, I can use that. It's like, I want to have sex with my mom or some other thing you can't really make into a novel. So I was lucky that I was able to get a plot out of that one.
Now that you've written a whole book about zombies, have the dreams gone away or changed?
I've had one since January where I finally did my first draft, finished my first draft. So, you know, perhaps I've silenced the lambs. mostly, we'll see what happens.
Well, I'm having too much fun up here, but it seems churlish not to let folks chime in. I've got more questions, as you can see, but maybe other people have some too?
So it was nice to hear how much you like television. And at first I wanted to ask you like what three shows you're DVRing right now. Hmm. But maybe if we lived in some sort of apocalypse and you could only have three television channels, what would the three be?
Channels?
Yeah, like you could only have AMC, FX, and something. Or like what would your three channels be?
That's a good question. I think one would be like one of those nature channels. Just to remind me of all the stuff I meant to do before the role ended. I'm not sure. I mean, I feel like there's great TV on right now, but I'm really just stuck on Mad Men and Justified. I think those are really good. Boardwalk Empire, I thought, was really slow the first season. Now it's gotten better. Now that they realize it's really about Chalky White. You know, it took them a while to realize. There's not three stations. When I was a TV critic 15 years ago, it was a really sort of debased profession. Like, you know, only the scrubs were TV critics. Now it's actually a legit profession. And so I was doing it at the wrong time. So in the same way I talked about enjoying not having to do like trend pieces or big big picture things about the culture, I'm glad I can just consume TV and not have to have like big ideas about what's good, what's bad. I can watch The World's Biggest Loser and feel okay. Like,
I take it you don't watch Clockwork Orange with your daughter?
No, I mean, I'm trying to sneak in, not stuff like that, but like Raiders. Like, she's old enough for Raiders. Yeah. She's 7. She knows zombies from Scooby-Doo, but doesn't know that. She's like, zombies aren't scary. He's like, yes, they are. She didn't like the title Zone 1. She wanted it to be called A Wake of the Undead Army, which is sort of cumbersome.
How did you hit on the title? Was that also with you from the very outset?
I think for like 2 or 3 months it was called Monster Movie because it was inspired by movies and it was sort of, but that was like too meta. Mm. So I think once I had to become a post-apocalyptic city planner and figure out how to clear out Manhattan, and it seemed like you'd have a wall across Canal, and then you could, you know, clear out everything below Canal, and then you put a wall across 14th Street and clear out, you know, zone by zone. Zone 1 just seemed like a cool, nerdy, sci-fi-y, you know, title. Just inexplicably cool-sounding to, like, my inner fan of bad horror and science fiction movies.
Not just yours. Do you think parenthood has changed you as a writer?
I think so. I think, you know, some of the warmer stuff in Sag Harbor is due to just becoming a different kind of person and thinking about, you know, who I am and other people in a new sort of way. I mean, I used to joke that now that I'm a dad, like, instead of like having a gunshot where someone gets shot in the heart, it's just a flesh wound. And that was like true for like Apex and Sag Harbor, but then and then Zone 1. So, you know, I think, there's the kill everybody side, and there's the I love you little child side, and depending on the book, you know, that'll be more or less apparent. But I think what I was, you know, the affection I was describing for Caitlin and Gary, people who I would hate in real life, you know, I hope that that's there, and that you do feel for them and their the various things that happened to them in the book, you feel sympathy for them.
Other questions?
Yes. The part about the government in Buffalo was hilarious, and the Phoenix and the Rising. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. The the zombie apocalypse has come and gone, and they're reselling society. And the provisional government, which is based in Buffalo, which was a random choice. I just in the same way Connecticut, like having evil Connecticut be the Hellmouth, having Buffalo be the center of, you know, futurity appealed to me. So the provisional government is, you know, they've rebranded everyone who's a survivor. Survivor refugee is too much of a downer. So everyone is part of the American Phoenix. There's a theme song, like a sort of Bob Seger type anthem called Stop, Can You Hear the Eagle Roar? So as they're, you know, clearing out decomposing pets from Zone 1, they're humming, you know, Stop, Can You Hear the Eagle Roar? So it seemed like everyone, all survivors are pretty much the same as they were before the apocalypse. That was sort of one idea I had. So Caitlin is still very perky and, is going to do her sweeper job to the letter because that's how she's always a grade grubber, and she still is. So in the same way, it seems societal structures will still be the same and come back really quickly. So everything you hate about modern society, we're going to bring back with us because we're still here. So bureaucracy, marketing, corporate sponsorships, you can't just like loot whatever you want from Walgreens because that's property. So once civilization is stabilized, you have to have permission to steal Nike shoes. And so Nike has to be on board and they'll get tax breaks for donating Nikes to the cause. So it seemed like all the stupid stuff that we have to deal with every day, we're going to, you know, bring back fairly quickly. And that includes bureaucracy and marketing.
Another question?
I'm from Buffalo. Bob Seger was, and I'm sure is still pretty big. Can you tell us, in your zombie universe, when a zombie sees themselves in the mirror, do they see themselves or just another zombie?
The stragglers, I think they're always seeing themselves. All they can see is a sort of narcissistic loop of who they used to be. Most zombie tales start on day one or the first week or the first month. So, how can I make it different? So 2 years later, all that stuff about how it spreads and the particularities of zombie psychology. Do they fart, burp? Do they dream of electric sheep? I wasn't really interested in that. The zombie apocalypse is a fact. And then now it's a fact. Where do we go from there? So I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm trying to think of maybe scenes from Day of the Dead when they're trying to like train Bud, the zombie that they're trying to bring back to life. And I think he's sort of aware of himself. So there are examples of zombies that over time, become a little more aware of their surroundings. For me, that wasn't what the book was about.
Another question?
Two quick questions. First, do your former friends still play poker with you?
Sorry, I have no idea. Okay, there you are. Okay. The game's sort of dying anyway just because everyone's busy and stuff like that. And then once I busted out of the World Series on day two, it goes like 7 days, I'd been in Vegas for 5 days. So I immediately flew to Portland. I got like a cheap Orbitz flight and flew to Portland where the Tin House Writers Workshop was going on. And I have a lot of friends there. So I played with them, and it was like playing with a bunch of brain-damaged monkeys. Because I had learned the real way how to play, and there are certain conventions of betting, and you respect them. And they were just like, I'm all in, with anything. And I was like fuming. So I'm in like this weird zombie state where I can't go back to my home game because I'd just be fed up. And then I'm not going to start going to Atlantic City every weekend. So I have no idea what to do.
The second question, more serious, as an urban observer, you've talked about memory of places and things coming back, and I'm curious: do you actively mine the city for those memories, or do those memories come to you?
They come to me. I think walking around Lower Manhattan and taking pictures, right out a few weeks after I had that dream, was useful just to, location scout. I never actually looked at them, but I was trying to think of what buildings I wanted, the book to take place in. I think, to elaborate on what I was saying before, the post-apocalyptic city, it's there because I'm superimposing it, but also we exist in that city, in sort of quiet moments sometimes. So like, it's 1 a.m., the first snow of the year, and you're walking home from your friend's house or a bar, and there are no tracks in the snow. There are no cars. For 10 minutes before, a bus goes by or a taxi, the city is dead and desolate, and you're in zone one of the book. And even with the main character has dreams of hallucinations of floating ash, which are human remains that have been incinerated. And I guess the blizzard is, human remains. Wall Street itself, between 9 p.m. and 5 a.m. is the zone one in the book. No one lives there. No one works there, after a certain hour. And so you can get trapped on Church or Wall Street and be in that post-apocalyptic city. So, I mean, my sensation of it is that I'm always like stumbling into weird zone ones all the time.
I've actually got a follow-up for the getting too good at poker answer. Is there an analog to that in literature? I mean, you grew up on, like we all did, sort of cheesy pulpy fiction, and now you're writing, you're swinging for the fences. You're writing grown-up adult fiction. Can you go back and still enjoy the living daylights out of a great, unambitious genre novel like you didn't know any better but to absolutely adore when you were a little kid?
Yeah, I mean, I don't... I guess, you know, crime novels, yeah. I mean, I don't read that much horror nowadays. I'm really sort of an antecedent. I was thinking of Stephen King, his late 70s, early 80s run. So I love, you know, B-movies definitely. I can always watch some Roger Corman thing, you know, biker movie. You know, those are hilarious. And so, yeah, I mean, not with the same, I think, manic glee. I mean, I know that these are sad people who tried to make it in Hollywood, you know. I sort of know what goes into it. I know that they were trying to make a good movie sometimes and just failing because they were totally incompetent. So I have more sympathy for artistic failure now.
That you're a success.
Now, you know, I know how hard it is to actually, you know, pull it off, so.
Other questions?
I'm curious about the name of the protagonist. There's this whole stream of consciousness thing with the idea of Mark Spitz. And I'm interested if, well, obviously swimming is a zombie-like activity. But how did you come to that choice? And how was the real persona, did it have anything to do with your choice?
I mean, he gets the nickname Mark Spitz, in tradition with, you know, nicknames that soldiers give each other in the trenches. Like, hey, Brooklyn, you know, Four Eyes. To me, I first heard of Mark Spitz through reading my sister's old Mad magazines. You know, I started reading comics in 78. She was a little older. And Mark Spitz was like a running joke in early 70s Mad magazines. And so for me, he was never actually a real person. He's just like this, someone who won a bunch of gold medals in this abstracted Olympics. So, I mean, so there's a pun. He gets this nickname ironically. It was a sort of, you know, not huge joke. I, you know, came up very early in the book. And in conceiving of who he is in the book, he's not heroic, he's not Olympian, he's very mediocre. He would never get 8 gold medals in anything except being unexceptional. And I think in the same way I was like, how am I conceiving of this apocalypse? The survivors are all like B students. They've always muddled through, they're human cockroaches, they never really succeeded, they never really failed. If you're a really successful, high-functioning person in the apocalypse, you'd kill yourself immediately. If you're like a D, C or D personality, like me, you'd be cut down quickly because you have no skills and you're too stupid to adapt to the new world. So that leaves like people who just always muddled through, and that's actually a successful adaptation in the world. So it's an ironic nickname, and you can sort of see him being where he earns it halfway through the book.
If you suddenly woke up into an action movie or the apocalypse came down, you must have asked yourself this as you watch these movies, as we all do. Do you think you would be Gene Hackman in The Poseidon Adventure and you would rise to heroic heights? Sure. Or would you be Ernest Borgnine? What do you think?
Yeah, everyone's, I mean, you want to be Gene Hackman just for like the cool turtleneck from the 70s. But, you know, the only way I would survive is if, I was going to say I'm out camping in the woods, but I never camped in my life, nor am I going to start. But I'm away from New York when the meteor hits. Like, I have to have some kind of weird errand that gets me out of town when the meteor comes. You know, I can't be here in the earthquake. You know, I'm not going to be carrying, you know, some 8-year-old down the ruined cement stairwell like Charlton Heston, you know. I'm going to be dead. So.
One last question, maybe. And then I've got one up my sleeve.
One of the things that I think was that Sag Harbor addressed that was interesting is it brought to people's minds that didn't know anything about an African-American kind of childhood of privilege on the East Coast. They didn't know anything about that world. And so I think it was a great book, first of all. My question to you is, as a writer, how has that kind of informed all of your books from Colossus and your characters specifically from Colossus all the way through Zone One. How has that kind of colored your perception of New York, how you perceive it politically, socially, et cetera?
Well, I mean, so glad you like the book. For me, the setup is this black enclave in the Hamptons. And then, but if the book succeeds or lives outside of, you know, its sort of publication window, it's because it speaks to universal ideas of being isolated, an outsider, teenage yearning, identity formation. So we talked about being an observer. I think that helps immensely in being a writer, being an outsider in various sorts of social situations gives you a different sort of perspective on what's going on, so that helps. Race is important in some of my books, not so much in other books. In Zone One, we talk about, are we in a post-racial society? And for me, it's no. Obama was elected, but then like hit some switch where everyone's non-racist. And I guess, you know, I always think it's like Neanderthals and saber-tooths. Like, did they say, like, are we in a post-saber-tooth society? If you're asking the question, saber-tooths are still around. Like, you only say that when you're like us, and you've never seen a saber-tooth in your whole life. So it seemed like in the apocalypse, we're in a post-racial, it'll take the apocalypse to be in a post-racial state, because when you're in that bunker in the freezer and you're surrounded by 10,000 zombies, it doesn't matter, like, about the person's skin color or funny accent or whatever, you just want to survive. So being a black outsider in white spaces, being a black outsider in black spaces, that's definitely, it's forming different ways in how I see people and my work. And then that part, and then that part is expressed in some books, and then part of being a city dweller is more important in other books. So it's just one of many things. Being a geek is, part. So it's just one of the many things that, informs, how I look at the world, and that, makes my books.
Zone One is so different from Sag Harbor. And you said earlier you try to come out with something completely different every time, if not the opposite of what came before it. And just finally here, I wonder, I'm a little sad that means I'm probably not going to get to read another Colson Whitehead action novel. Thoughtful, contemplative, full of interesting ideas, but also really terrific action novel. And so I wonder, what are the relative risks and benefits of your approach of trying to do something different every time versus somebody like George Romero, whereas if that had been his approach after Night of the Living Dead, we'd never have gotten Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, I mean, I've chosen different projects, from book to book, just to keep it, fresh for me and, stay alive creatively. I think something changed with Sag Harbor in this book. Like, I really love the voice, the first-person voice of Sag Harbor, and I'd like to have somebody, another character who's as perceptive and, making jokes that are, being set up for 200 pages. So I missed that book a lot, and that was new for me. And I missed Zone One a lot, even though it was really grueling. There are characters like Mim or the Lieutenant, I think particularly the Quiet Storm, who was a late addition, who would like to hang out with again. So I'm done with Mark Spitz, but I like the zombie world. So maybe I'd go back, revisit it again, and that would be breaking the rule, like you're supposed to.
But breaking the rule is what you do every time. You've never done a sequel before. You got to do it at least once.
Yeah. And then the Benji character, I'm not sure if I want to hang out with him again, but definitely that voice, having that kind of limber first-person voice would be fun to do again. So we'll see.
Well, we'll certainly be watching. Finish up that book tour and then go back to work. Ladies and gentlemen, Colson Whitehead.
Thanks, David.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.